What's up, everybody, and welcome back. Welcome back to the Bridging of the Gap podcast. I hope you're all well. We had a nice brief bit of weather in the summer, in the UK, which made me think it was summertime. And then I looked outside this morning and realized, no, it's summertime sadness. As always, the weather is shite again. I'm here with a podcast today for you. We're going to talk bodybuilding stuff. Who would have thought? We've got a lot to talk to. I'm going to talk about what to do when you're struggling with progress. I'm going to talk about wrist cuffs and bands. I'm going to talk about macronutrient timing. I'm also going to talk about when is the time to take steroids. When is there a go point? Is there a go point? But first things first, as always, I'm going to take a sip of my 3D energy drink. Because it tastes so goddamn good and I've had no food today. And it's a rest day and my food is very, very low. This actually tastes like a meal. So don't hate me for it. Right, guys. Are you struggling with progress? If the answer is yes, let me help you. So when we look at progress in the gym, there's a fair few things that we need to consider. Training, nutrition, recovery, all these different things. And now the normal question I get is, I can't progress my bench press because this, you know, and the because is never linked to actually why it is because. But let me talk you through the things that I see most and that I see the problem being with people's progress and their struggles. First things first is volume. People do too much volume. If you're doing 3, 4, 5 sets an exercise, I would argue there's probably a little bit too much. How much of that is going to be efficient? We know that there has to be a minimum intensity when we do train. For example, we call it a rate of perceived exertion, right? Or a reps in reserve. How many are you leaving in reserve? If 10 was ultimate muscular failure, we know that you probably want to be aiming towards a 7 out of 10. We know that if you go below a 7 out of 10, your chances of hypertrophy diminish pretty quickly. So there is a minimum intensity. The problem is that people don't find 10 out of 10 failure. So then they kind of, you know, they're constantly at this like 5 or 6, so they're just making slower gains. So first things first is going to be remove some volume. If you're doing 3 sets, try 2. If you're doing 4 sets, try 3. If you're doing 5 sets, come right down to 2 or 3. Because I promise you, the effort that you can put into those 2 sets will massively exceed what you can put into over 5 sets. And we know that a huge driver of hypertrophy is just muscle damage. And we know that like progressively getting stronger, like with heavier weight, will cause muscle damage and will be a direct route to hypertrophy. Building up volume over time, yes, it does work as well. It's just a combination of are you working maybe too hard for too long, which is not allowing you to recover, etc., etc. For example, when I used to train, I used to do 4 or 5 sets, and every set was to failure. And I used to do drop sets and supersets, and I used to absolutely smash myself into the ground. And I came away feeling wrecked, but actually a lot of that was just central nervous system fatigue, and a lot of that was a lot of offload onto passive tissues. Because when the muscle is fatigued, and it will happen, you just offload that onto something else. You know, for example, if you're doing a bench press and you keep benching till you fail, eventually you're going to offload all of that weight onto the ligaments and tendons that insert, that connect the insertion points of the pec, the sternoclavicular joint. You're just going to like use that elastic tension in the tendons and in the passive tissues to get that weight up. So it's a fine line between doing enough volume to grow, but also not doing too much that you're going to move the pressure away from the active tissues to the passive tissues, but then also be able to put your effort in consistently across that workout. So first things first is going to be volume, assess your volume. If you're doing 20 sets a session, you're doing too much. You know, let me give you an example of a session for me. I'll take a push session, for example. I'll warm up with like some cuffed flies. 2 sets, 1 top set, 1 back off set. All of it is all at failure. I will then do 1 mechanical loading set, we call it, you know, like a big heavy loading press, whether that's a dumbbell or a machine. I will then go back down to either another isolation with maybe like a rest pause on it, and I'm done. So that's 2 sets, 2 sets. maybe 2 or 3 sets. So that's 6 or 7 sets in my session that I'm doing, and I'm probably doing that session twice a week. So you can imagine I'm only doing between 10 and 14 sets of my chest a week. And that will kind of be relative across all muscle groups. So obviously back being a bigger muscle, I'll probably hit 14 to 16. Legs being a bigger muscle, I'll probably hit, you know, maybe 18 to 16 across my hamstrings, glutes and quads and delts. Obviously wanting to deliver a lot more volume to where you want to grow. I want to grow my delts. They're going to be very, very similar. So I think the volume is the first thing that you need to assess. If you're doing too many sets, just halve them and just see what happens. Halve them and up your intensity. Halve them and go to failure. I promise you, you will see progress. The next thing we need to consider is recovery. Are you focused on recovery? Are you actively recovering, or are you just going to the gym to train to wait until your next train? It's what you do between those sessions that will define what happens in the next session. And this comes from fueling yourself right. This comes from resting. This comes from keeping active if you need to. This comes from massage, chiropractor, bath salts. This comes from stretching. All these different things that can encourage recovery. They need to be managed, or at least if they're not being managed, it could be an answer as to why you're not progressing. Are you sleeping right? We know from research, and if you look at the top guys in the industry, Matthew Walker, Rhonda Patrick, talking about sleep, we know that if you sleep less than seven, which is pretty decent for most people, less than 7 hours a night, you are increasing your risk of all-cause mortality by up to 25%, if not more, which is absolutely insane. So, you know, I cannot tell you how many people I know that sleep 5 or 6 hours a night. You're genuinely killing yourself, and you're genuinely increasing your chances of things like dementia, things like Alzheimer's. As we know, they have a really, really direct link to sleep. So not only that, but sleep will enhance your fat loss. Sleep will enhance your muscle growth. It will help your natural secretions of hormones, for example, testosterone, growth hormone, melatonin, serotonin, all of these things that help you get to sleep, stay asleep, grow, recover, repair. They all kind of get secreted and are removed around the body through chemical exchange during sleep. So inevitably, if you're shortening that sleep, you are diminishing your ability to utilize these hormones, which, by the way, function everything. Obviously, if you're on exogenous hormones and growth hormone, you don't need to worry too much about that. You're going to grow regardless. But for everyone else out there, you've got to be focusing on your sleep, and you've got to be actively sleeping, not just, oh, I'm going to go to bed now and lie and play on my phone until I fall asleep. You need to be thinking, no, this is sleep time now, and make that conscious decision to sleep. If you want some more information on sleep directly, go onto YouTube and just type in my name and sleep, Josh Bridgman Sleep. I have like 2 or 3 videos directly on sleep. They are slightly different from each other. Like, some have different tips in another one, so you could watch them all and you could gain so much information from those. And I genuinely implement all of those things every single day to the point that they're now autonomous. Yes, they may seem like, oh, I've got to wear blue light blockers every night. Oh, I've got to not be on my phone in bed. But once you do it for like 2 or 3 weeks, you don't even think about it. You just don't do it, you know, because you see the benefits and you feel the benefits. For example, last night I was up a little bit later, playing around on my phone, you know, talking to my girlfriend late at night, and that affected my sleep, you know, among the other things and the stresses of prep. But I feel like that might have affected my sleep, whereas normally I'm asleep 45 minutes earlier. Maybe I was awake 45 minutes later. That's not necessarily a problem. It's just about making that connection to recovery and understanding why maybe today cardio was a little bit harder, you know, training was a little bit harder, and making that connection is key. So if you're not progressing in the gym and maybe you had a shit night's sleep, I'm telling you that will be one of the reasons why, you know. So focus on your recovery. We've talked about volume a little bit. Touching on frequency, like, frequency doesn't really necessarily affect progress, but what I would say is if you're doing your bro splits, and you're trying to get your full 20 sets of bro split sessions a week. For example, what I just said was I do about 10 to 14 sets a week, a session on my chest. Sorry, I do about 6 to 8 sessions on my chest each session. If I do 2 of those sessions, that's 12 to 14. So if you're trying to do those 12 to 14 sets in one session, do you think, I'm going to allow you to think here, do you think that the 14th set that you do on the day that you've done 13 sets, working sets before, is going to be as efficient as doing the 14th set on a day that you've only done 7 sets, if that makes sense. So what you can get out of your workload per week can be massively increased by breaking that up into more frequency. So it's not that frequency is necessarily going to give you more muscle and you're sending a more frequent signal, though that may play a part. You're sending a very frequent, strong signal to the body that we need to grow or we need to progress and adapt. But actually what you're doing is just breaking up your total work volume, which is there anyway, and just making it into more bite-sized chunks that you can improve that efficiency, you know. So let's just throw arbitrary numbers out there that don't really count. But, you know, they're there for reference point. If you do 14 sets in one session, you know, you get to like set 10. And that diminished, that like diminished energy, that effort that you're putting in, it diminishes. It gets harder and harder as you go through, you know. So that percentage of what you're activating, the muscle recruitment that you're doing in those last 4 sets is just incomparable to splitting that dose in half, you know. Whereas you may flag it at set 8 or 9 and you've still got 5 sets to go. If you just cut it there at set 8 or 9 when you're flagging, and you do the other 5 to 6 sets later on in the week, I promise you those 5 to 6 sets later on in the week will be more productive than the earlier sets. So think about frequency, think about your volume, don't do it all at once, split it up to make it manageable and recoverable, which is the key word here. You know, I can't give you an amount to do. Those numbers that I use for myself are just something that I've used over the years. I started at 4 or 5 a week for chest, literally 4 or 5 sets a week. I then built up to 8, I then built up to 12. I now know that if I go higher than where I am right now, I tend to not recover, I tend to not progress as much, so I pull it back down. And it's not even that your coach can see that, and I've got so many clients that ask, you know, can I put the volume up here? Can I take the volume down here? Well, it's not necessarily, like, the coach isn't just going to be like, yeah, you need more volume here. Like, that's not how it works. There's so much internal feedback and biofeedback and things that will be affected by doing too much or doing too little that you need to kind of, it's a work in progress, right? So I'm here to just kind of help you connect the dots and some of these dots that could be there. Another thing that you could be focusing on is just the same exercise every fucking time. A huge thing that I get from young guys messaging me is, I want to increase my bench press, deadlift, and squat. Well, why? Why do you want to increase those? Those exercises don't give you any more or less than anything else do. In fact, I would argue they probably take away from you more than other exercises. For example, how taxing is a deadlift session? You know, you do 2-3 sets all out failure on deadlift, so you know that the rest of your session is going to be hard. Whereas if you didn't have that in and you targeted more volume to isolations and stuff, you could probably manage your central nervous system a little bit better. So don't get married to exercises. If you're just doing an exercise, for example, incline dumbbell press was my nemesis for a good 12 to 14 weeks. I progressed it, got to the last few weeks, and I just couldn't progress it anymore. And that was a time where I could rotate this exercise out because I'd got what I needed out of it. You know, I'd taken it from 50 to 65 kilos on the incline. And to get another 15 kilos was going to be very, very difficult and very, very long. So noticing when you've been running an exercise for a very long time, the adaptation response slows, you know. So that myth of shocking the muscle really comes from adaptation. So we can't shock the muscle. There's no such thing as shocking the muscle. The brain dictates everything. How can you shock a muscle when you know that you're going to do it? Your brain already tells the muscle that you're going to do it, you know? But that process of establishing a movement to use, learning the movement pattern and the motor pattern for, you know, 3 to 4 weeks, because you'll find that, you know, if you've not dumbbell pressed and you've always been barbell pressing, you go to dumbbell presses, everything feels like unstable. Well, all those little stabilizer muscles are just learning the motor patterns and getting stronger in that movement. So once you get over that period, then you force adaptation and then you just exhaust that, you know. And if everything else is in place, you should progress and progress and progress until a point where you get diminishing returns, and then you can rotate the exercise out. So be conscious of if you've been trying to do the same exercise for a very long time and it's just not moving. For example, a squat, try a hack squat, try a pendulum squat, try a V squat. There's so many different things that get great, great connections to these muscles and work them in their full range of motion and don't give you as much fatigue as, say, like a squat would. So be tactical in the way that you're choosing exercises and make sure you're not just exhausting one exercise over a very long period of time and you've not been benching for 4 years and you're worried about your bench press not going up. Just change it out. And then I promise you, when you come back to it in another 12 weeks, when you can rotate it back in, you're going to be just as strong, if not stronger. Now, it's very, very easy for me to say, control your volume, make sure you're recovering, you know, make sure you're not exhausting exercises, make sure you balance your frequency. But none of this would be as efficient without looking at your nutrition. Now, if you're struggling with progress and you've been in a deficit for a very long time, it doesn't take a genius to draw the dots, does it? Like, you've got less energy, you've got more output, you've got less available energy to increase and progress in the gym. It becomes an uphill battle. So let's not talk about a deficit. Let's talk about if you're in a surplus and you're starting to slow. My question to you is, are you fueling yourself for that session or are you eating shit food? Are you eating something that's going to be easy for your digestion, something that's going to assimilate very, very easy? For example, we know that chicken is pretty easy on the digestive system. We know that rice is pretty easy on the digestive system. If we take that in contrast and we go to KFC and we have a deep fried chicken breast and we put that in a sunflower oiled bun or bap, which one's going to serve you better? Which one's going to fuel your body better? Which one's going to be better for digestion, for energy, for utilization in energy production? It's pretty straightforward. So with session nutrition, I'm not a fucking, you have to eat healthy kind of dude. Like, I personally just eat healthy because I know what the shit food does to me and will do to me if I continually eat it for a very long time. But general rule of thumb, guys, get 80% of your food from single ingredient food that doesn't have a big long list on the back of it. The rest of the 20%, like, that's fine, you know, and then move that away from your workout window where possible. Like, I eat Cocoa Pops post-workout, you know, very, very easy on the stomach. Yes, they have loads of numbers on the back, but it's very, very easy and it's mostly rice-based. So be conscious of what you're putting in your body and when. I'm going to talk a little bit macronutrient timing in a little bit, so I'm not going to go too much into that. Hydration, are you hydrated? I can't tell you how much the hydration will affect you. It really, really will. And actually, not to push a supplement here, but since I incorporated electrolytes and taurine into my intra workout, I've never noticed more benefits than ever in terms of pump, in terms of blood flow, in terms of not flagging and energy, because I've got a little bit of sodium in there, potassium and taurine that just helps cellular hydration along with the big influx of water. It really promotes a good workout and that's throughout the whole day. You know, hydrate when you wake up. We've been without water for 8 hours at night. You know, you wake up, you have a big piss, and then you're just dehydrated. What do you do? What's the first thing you do? Well, the first thing that I do is hydrate myself and get everything going. We know that hydrating yourself with a pinch of mineral salt can lower your blood glucose, your fasted blood glucose immediately, and help cellular hydration and just help your body, process everything. And, you know, water is a huge, like, if you're dehydrated, you have thicker blood. If you're more hydrated, you have, you know, less viscous blood, so you can transport more nutrients, get more blood flow, more vasodilation, and a better pump. So it will help. Furthermore, in terms of nutrition, there's not much else to say that other than what I want to go into in macronutrient timing, but assess your volume, make sure you're not doing too much, make sure you sleep pretty fucking good. Don't do the same exercises for 6 to 12 months. Do them for like 2 to 3 months, then change. Don't constantly chop and change your workouts because there's no way to track progress. If you go in and do bench press every single Monday, you know that you need to progress that weight up in terms of progressively overload. We know that the big driver of hypertrophy is progressively overloading volume because that increases muscle damage, metabolic stress, and in turn, hypertrophic response. So make sure that you're not cutting yourself short in terms of training. And recovery and nutrition, all those kind of things. So those are some little things that I think will help. Let's go into macronutrient timing just because it is a nice transition into that. So if you want to maximize your hypertrophic ability, your ability to grow muscle, your ability to increase lipolysis, aka burn fat, or the breakdown of fatty acids, there is good research now into macronutrient timing, and promoting metabolic flexibility, things like post-workout carbohydrates, you know, regular protein feedings. There is method to the madness now, and I'm going to talk you through what I think is the optimal setup, generally speaking. And now this is a marginal gain. This may be 1% or a whatever, you know, it's not going to be a game changer, but I'm positive that if you are someone who is tracking all the variables and you want to increase your ability to accrue tissue or whatever, this will help, and the research now backs it. But before, 3D time. It gets better every sip. So let's start with protein. So protein, we know, is a huge building block for muscle protein synthesis, which is a constant battle that we are on. We know that we need muscle protein breakdown, which is essentially muscle breakdown. We know that in order to grow, we need muscle protein synthesis. Now, while we actively need muscle protein breakdown, we just need to tilt the favor into muscle protein synthesis. And there are things that we can do to tilt that balance in the favor of muscle protein synthesis. Now, protein feedings is one of them. Now, generally speaking, a protein source that is a complete protein and has a full amino acid complex is what you're aiming for here. Really, you want about 3 to 4 grams of leucine per meal. Roughly speaking, if you've got a complete amino acid complex, which, just like for reference, is pretty much any animal protein, every 10 grams, you probably get like a gram of leucine. So you want a minimum of like 30 grams per meal so that you can have a big bump of leucine, which is a key driver in muscle protein synthesis, but also having that full range of amino acids to complement leucine. So we know that we want regular protein muscle protein synthesis spikes from protein, 30 to 40 grams, 3 to 4 grams of leucine per meal, highly bioavailable source, every like 4 hours. Now, the whole every 2 to 3 hour thing, that I think that's more for just people who can't get the food in and they need to constantly be eating to get the food in to put on weight. Realistically speaking, if you break down digestion and you think about digestion and the moment that we put food in our mouth that goes through our esophagus, into our stomach, into our intestine and passing through into our colon, that whole process can take anywhere from 3 to 5 hours. Obviously, if you're in an off season and highly saturated with food, it's probably going to be more towards 5 hours. If you're in a cut like me, like I'm going to absorb a fucking omelet in an hour, 2 hours, you know, it's going to be very, very quick. The difference is going to be a lot. So considering where you are, you could probably get away with anywhere between 3 and 5 hours, but you want the full meal to digest. You want blood sugar to return back to normal. We know that amino acids and protein can spike blood sugar and insulin. So to reduce that variability across the day, we just kind of, you know, have time between meals. So you can expect to be back down to baseline 2.5, 3 hours post-meal, you know, wait another hour, then you can get your next protein feeding in. And we know that spacing out throughout the day can help the balance of muscle protein synthesis into muscle protein breakdown. So that is something to consider. It doesn't boost your metabolism like regular meals. That's not a thing. Metabolism is fairly fixed day to day, and it will adapt with like long bouts of pushing up in surplus or long bouts in deficit, and it will adapt up or down accordingly. But in terms of protein feedings, that's the most optimal thing in terms of muscle protein synthesis. If you ever want any of these studies, I'll probably just put them in the show notes so you guys can click on them. Or if you want to message me, DM me, I can send them over to you. But these are based off studies. The next thing will be intra-workout. So there's some pretty good research into intra-workout carbohydrates and EAAs, essential amino acids, again, looking for that leucine content. The combination of both seems to mitigate muscle protein breakdown. Now, if you look at muscle protein breakdown, it's at its highest when we work out inevitably, because we're actually breaking down muscle. We are microfibril tears that we are encouraging through training, through intensity, through whatever we're doing. We are breaking down muscle. So that is muscle protein breakdown. And there is a direct alleviation of that muscle protein breakdown. Not entirely, but it can help mitigate some muscle protein breakdown intra-workout by sipping on a an EAA, and for example, a carb powder like hyaluronic acid extraction, just because it's pretty easy. No more than like 15 grams of EAAs and like 15, 20 grams of carbs, and you can just help that little balance. And there was a really, really good study into it, which is pretty, pretty cool. But when we think about muscle protein breakdown and muscle protein synthesis and that balance, it's not actually a sole focus on muscle protein synthesis, because we need muscle protein breakdown. In fact, there was one cool study done that they injected mice who are 97% identical to us genetically, which is fucking crazy, by the way. Imagine what that 3% does to make us look different from mice. They injected and inhibited all muscle protein breakdown pathways that these mice went through. And they fat, so, you know, they were just anabolic as fuck all the time, muscle protein synthesis the whole time, because they didn't have muscle protein breakdown pathways. And they found that the mice just withered and died. So that is a huge call to say that muscle protein breakdown is needed. And maybe it's part of the detoxification process. Maybe it's part of some other process. I don't know enough about it to be able to comment anymore, but that was a cool little study that I thought would be worth talking about. And so while we are fighting for this balance of muscle protein synthesis and breakdown, both are needed, you know, but we're just trying to help mitigate it where we can. And we know that intra workout can do that. In terms of like carbohydrates, now I get this a lot because I always put my you know, like prep update on my Instagram. If you don't follow me, Josh Bridgman, by the way. And I'll put like, you know, start weight, current weight, current macros, training day macros, non-training day macros. And people always comment that my non-training day macros are a lot lower. Now, let me give you the reasons why my non-training day macros are lower. And by macros, really, I'm just talking about carbohydrates. My carbohydrates are lower on non-training days. So there's a multitude of reasons for that. I think first and foremost is just going to be the glycogen demand is higher on a training day, obviously, because I'm training, and we know that carbohydrates are the most readily sourced available energy for the body, the most usable energy for something like weight training. Obviously, if we were working, you know, like in a marathon or anything like that, we could probably look away from carbohydrates. But when we want that short energy burst, carbohydrates seem to be favorable. So it makes sense for us to feel that. We know that performance in a deficit and, in fact, a surplus is everything, because if you can continuously perform at a high level and fuel yourself right, you increase your chances of hypertrophy, you increase your chances of gaining muscle and burning body fat. So being able to balance that demand for carbohydrates on training days, but then giving yourself enough to be able to recover on non-training days, I think really, really benefits you. Replenishing the glycogen post-workout, there is an upregulation of a glucotransporter called GULT4, glucotransporter 4. You could literally just Google GULT4 upregulation. So training stimulates the upregulation of this glucose transporter, which essentially is exactly what it sounds like. It gives us the ability to transport more glucose. So actually the anabolic window is more for carbohydrates. You know, we have an ability to shuttle more carbohydrates post-workout, which is why you'll see, you know, the bodybuilders these days having that huge, you know, cereal post-workout or easy digest post-workout, because they're trying to make use of this GULT4 upregulation post-workout. So that is another reason why carbohydrates would be higher on those days. We also have stores to replenish post-workout. Also helps with recovery, also can help with sleep a little bit. It also helps promote metabolic flexibility. So while on a training day, I'll be having glycogen with pretty much every meal, while be it's pretty small at the moment. When I'm on a non-training day, like first 1 to 3 meals are going to be just protein and fat. And they're going to really kind of help promote me switching over to an energy system where I'm using fat as energy and maybe encourage lipolysis of my own fatty stores. And it just helps us with that metabolic flexibility to switch over to using carbohydrates, to switch over to using fats. I don't know too much about, or I don't want to go in too much about, you know, flicking that switch to using fats as energy. Like, I think it's probably a lot more complex than just fasting carbohydrates from a few meals. But also fasting carbohydrates for a few meals on a non-training day promotes a little bit more insulin sensitivity, as it doesn't have to rise so much and come back down for every single meal. It also allows more. So obviously, if you're it's a little bit different when you're in a deficit, but it also allows more fats. So obviously where you pull down your carbohydrates for the glycogen demand being less, you could put your fats up, and it gives you a better like micronutrition profile of essential fatty acids, more omegas, you know, more benefits that fats bring. You can focus on those a little bit on those days while keeping fats a little bit lower on training days. So there is reason why we have more carbohydrates on a training day. And that is like a big portion of why, just to promote that metabolic flexibility, the GLT-4 expression being upregulated, et cetera, et cetera. I think that pretty much touches on macronutrient timing. You know, regular protein feeding, prioritize your carbohydrates around the workout window, eat fats whenever you can do, you know, pretty much. I wanted to move on to cuffs and bands and all these cool little tricks that people are using these days to enhance your resistance profile. But what does it actually mean? What do these things actually mean? Well, let me use cuffs as an example. You may have seen me use cuffs in my lateral raises on a cable machine. Here's the reason why. For one, cable machine, constant tension in the shortest position to the longest position of the delt. Essentially, longest would be like when your hands are like down in the middle and your delt is stretched out the most. Shortest would be when it's contracted the most. If you look at the function of the delt in abduction, which is literally, if you're standing side by side, this is hard to do on a podcast and explain, but if you're standing side by side, hands down facing forward, and you lift your hands up to the sky, like outwards and upwards, that is abduction. So that is one of the functions of the delt, and that is the function of the delt that we're trying to work through in a lateral raise with the cuffs. If I'm to hold handles and load, versus have the cuffs on my elbow and load, which you might have seen me do, there is absolutely no difference in distance and load traveled or used in the delt. So if you can put your hand out, imagine holding something out high and lifting it all the way up to the sky, the distance that moves is no different than if that same thing was on your elbow. The only difference that causes is more internal joint pressure, which essentially is not what we're trying to do, right? We're trying to, at all turns of exercise mechanics, we're trying to reduce internal joint pressure and increase the line of force onto the muscle, which is essentially just tension on the muscle. So by manipulating where that load is placed, either on the hand, on the elbow, you know, even higher, you can really reduce internal joint pressure and get the same amount of hypertrophic stimulus that you would do, but just safely. You know, it's much like a shoulder press. Do you put the bench perfectly up straight and kind of tweak your shoulder a little bit? Or do you put it down into like a high incline and yeah, okay, you get a little bit more upper chest, but your shoulder's way safer, you know? It's one of those decisions that actually just makes things a little bit safer while giving you the same results, if not better results because of the connection. That's cuffs, like cuffs will do that. You can do it for pretty much everything. Everything that you could use a cuff for example. And then things like bands. So bands, you can imagine, add resistance to a movement. For example, if I stick a band on a leg press, what happens? It gets harder at the top, right? So the reason why we would stick a band on something like a leg press is because when the quad is short or when the quad is contracted, it's at its strongest. Yeah, and that makes sense, right? When you're down in the hole of a squat, you're not necessarily, you know, and your knees are really forward and your quad is fully extended, you're probably not in the strongest position for your quad. But when you're at the top and you're contracted, you can fucking brace hard against the pad or whatever, you are. So adding resistance to that portion of the movement with the band, and then also when you're in the lengthened position, so imagine you're in a leg press and your legs come all the way down, because the band is there and it's adding tension, you've got less weight on the actual bar on the sides, less plates on the leg press. So when you're in that position where your quad's fully lengthened and you know you're in a range of motion where everything's, you know, come down, you have less pressure and less weight on you. So you cause less joint pressure, less pressure in the positions where you're weakest, and then it adds resistance to those positions when you're strongest. It does work for different things. For example, you probably wouldn't band a lat pull down or a row, because actually the lat, when you look at the function of the lat is actually weaker in the shortened position, and it's stronger in the lengthened position. So you can manipulate exercises and their functions to make it harder in the position where the muscle's strongest and easier in the position where the muscle's weakest. And that's essentially what bands do. Yeah, you just got to look at the joint function, the amount of muscles involved, the movement you're trying to do, and you can just work out where the muscle's strong. To be honest, you can just feel it. You know, you can feel when the muscle's strong. You can always move a lat pull down the first third, right? You can always do that. Even when you fail, you always seem to get it like halfway down, and then you realize you can't get it any closer. That's because it's weak in the short position, short being contracted, right? So you can kind of work it out yourself by feeling the muscle, and it's the same thing for a press and a bicep curl and whatever. And these bands, reversing it or adding it, just change that profile and change where that load is placed. So they become very, very good tools to use for people. You know, they don't need to be the only way you do it, but it just needs to be more method in your exercise selection. You know, for example, if I load someone on hamstrings, which I like to do before a hack squat, your hamstrings and glutes still get a pretty decent load in the bottom of that hack squat. So actually what we can do to help that and offset that load on the hamstrings and glutes, which we've already loaded, not that we want to take the entire load away, but we could reverse band that. And reverse banding would be where the tension gets higher as you come down, so it helps you out of that hole, and then it gets harder as you load the quads. So it's about tactically thinking about your session like that, you know. For example, I had a really bad leg. Those of you guys that know, I had a bad jab in my leg. And when I got my leg into a fully lengthened position, it just fucking killed me. But when I was short, it was fine. So adding bands to my leg press, it just helped me so much. So start thinking about where you're strongest in these movements, and you can kind of just adjust, you know. And that's really it. Like, it's pretty simple. Like, it can be made so complicated. And when I'm sat here in exercise mechanics seminars, which I've been doing over the last few months, it's fucking complicated. But you can simplify it, and you can get a lot of take-homes from it. And these are the take-homes from it. So we kind of just getting seminars for free on here. Finally, guys, the last thing I wanted to talk about was going to be, when do you know that you should take steroids? Is there a set limit? Is there a position that you should be in to take steroids? Now, this is obviously a personal opinion. Like, this is a personal question and when I think you should do it. First and foremost, this is your life. You do whatever the fuck you want. You can do it now. You can do it in 10 years. You can never do it. But the most important thing you need to understand is the risks versus reward, and understanding that ratio. If the reward outweighs the risk, and if then great, you've got your decision made. But if you don't know the risks and you are very ignorant to the risks, for example, your hormones will never come back to the same when you start. You may never have kids again. I'm not saying this is highly likely, but these are risks. You are at more risk to atherosclerosis, heart attacks, high blood pressure, poor health. You know, all these things will have, you know, are you willing to take steroids for the rest of your life? These are huge risks that you need to understand before you find your reward ratio. But beyond that, there are things that I think should be in place before you start steroids. First of all, master training. Be skilled enough to train. Don't be in the learning process of not being able to lift fucking like 3 plates on a squat, you know, and then think, I'm going to get some gear in me. Be able to be exercise mechanically sound. Be in the position where you know how to manipulate your food. Be in a position where you understand recovery management and how to progress and how to change things if things go wrong. I think that's a foundation that you need. I think you're wasting time if you put gear in you and then you try and learn those things at the same time. I think you are going 2 steps backwards. But if you've got all these things in place, like I did, and you've got everything sorted before, you can really reap the rewards of a very, very low dose. And you can, you know, for example, like I did, you know, I'm fucking nearly 11 kilos heavier than I was last year at this stage, and I'm leaner than I was then. You know, that's crazy to think I've done that in like 7 months of gear use. But I think the most important thing is to understand your own risk to reward ratio. Understand your goals. Are you doing it to look good, or are you doing it to be a pro? This shit will kill you. This shit will kill you faster. You will take years off your life using it. It just depends on whether you're ready to or willing to do it, you know? And then if you'd make these decisions, you've got things in place, you've got, you know, however many years training under your belt. I don't even think there needs to be a certain amount of training. I don't think you need 5, 10, 15 years. I think you just need to be proficient at training. At the end of the day, if your goal is above the natural limit, why would you wait until the natural limit to get there? You know, like I would probably say that right now where I am, I would probably say that I could have got here naturally, but in another 5 to 6 years. And I don't have the time to do that. So I'm not here to wait for my natural limit. I'm here to just get what needs to be done. And if that's the case for you, like don't like be caught upon this, I need to look this certain way to start steroids. I don't think you should be skinny and fat and in a position where you look like you don't lift. I think you should definitely have the foundations there. But I wouldn't say there's a time limit on it, and I wouldn't say there is a right time to do it. It's just a risk versus reward ratio versus long-term goals versus everything else you need to consider. And then if you're ready for it, get a full blood test done. I use MediCheck. You can use Josh Bridgman at discount on MediCheck for a full blood panel, so you know where you need to return to when you come off gear or when you go to a cruise. You know where you need your levels need to come back to. For example, if you've naturally got high cholesterol and you come back and you've got, you know, higher cholesterol, you know that you need to bring it down, but it's probably still going to be high because your predisposition to that. So those little things can make a huge difference. Blood tests, get someone who can fucking coach you through it. I've not made one decision about my steroid cycle at all over this whole prep. I've had someone do it who I trust and know and explains to me. So that's something else you need. That's pretty much it, guys. Like, I was going to do a Q&A, but I think just those topics are cool to listen to. It's already been a while. I hope you guys enjoy the podcast. I hope you guys are enjoying the frequency of content here. I've made a commitment. I hope you've noticed the change, but I'm bringing you guys as much information and content and value as I can. I will have a fucking impact on this world, and I will do it to the best of my ability. So I appreciate you guys for stopping by. I appreciate you guys for listening. Don't forget to leave a rating on the store if you haven't already. Let me know what you think. If it's less than 5 stars, don't do it. Just message me and tell me why not. I'm joking. But thank you guys. Hope you have a great day. I shall speak to you soon. Peace and love always.